people, of course, have tons of anxiety. They're uptight about a whole lot of things. And one of the things they do to relieve this anxiety is tell Flatlander tales. And people have been writing to me from all up and down the Appalachians telling me, you know, we got these people here too, these Flatlanders. What is a Flatlander? It's a stereotypical person who comes usually from New Jersey. People, the worst Flatlanders live in New Jersey. Poor New Jersey, right? They get the brunt of everything. A Flatlander is somebody who comes usually in a Cherokee or a Blazer, has lots of real expensive guns, and goes out in the woods during hunting season. And hunting season is the time when these particular tensions reach a peak. The reason being that the Flatlanders go to the bars and buy the mountain women mixed drinks, which the Ridge Runners, they only buy them beer. And so the women, they all want to hang out with the Flatlanders, and it causes a lot of tension. So the transaction, from a psychological point of view, is to tell a lot of stories about these guys, and make them look bad. It's not that they hate them, it's that they make them feel inferior, they make them feel inadequate. And so they tell these stories which reverse the scheme of things. In the beginning of the story, the Flatlander looks real slick and rich and cunning and everything else, and the Ridge Runner looks like a kind of a simpleton, but as the story goes on, there's a reversal that takes place. And they're good stories, but what interests me is that they burn off a lot of anxiety. They burn off a lot of feelings of inadequacy and feelings of wondering, you know, just how do we stack up to these country folk. And here's one that I'd like to tell you, which takes place in a little town not far from where I live in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, which is the home of Little League Baseball, by the way. In a little town called Saladesburg, there's a man there named Thad Kohick, and he's had a general store there for ever so long. And in this store, you can buy just about anything. You can buy bear traps, and you can buy detergent, and you can buy candy, and you can buy ice cream cones. And Thad was the kind of guy who loved to just skin a Flatlander in a deal. He loved to jack up the prices when the hunters came in and get a lot of extra dough for ammunition and stuff like that. Until a few years ago, he went to one of those revival meetings and got converted, and he come down with what we called a bad case of religion. We used to sit around and swap a lot of stories with that in the store, but after this, he just wouldn't do it anymore. He was always coming up with these little scriptural quotes for everything that went on in his store, and had all these little nice little things he'd say, and he was living his life at the foot of the cross, he'd say. And I remember we were sitting around there one day, and little Becky Spencer from up in English Center come in and got some whorehound candy, and he gave her her change and walked to the front door and opened it up, and out she went. And he went on back to the cash register, which is where he'd usually go, and put his fingers on the keys and looked up to heaven and said, "Lord, suffer the little children to come unto me." This is not the guy we used to know. It's a different man entirely, just living his life for Jesus. And a little while later, Mrs. Johnson come in from Trout Run. She bought some material, and this is a woman with a lot of kids. And he made her change and opened a door for her and let her out. And then he went on back up to the cash register and put his fingers on the keys and looked up to heaven, said, "Lord, honor thy father and thy mother." Boy, we couldn't believe it. Then all of a sudden, a great big pickup truck pulled up in front of the store. And behind it had one of those horse trailers, one of those brand new horse trailers. And out of the truck jumped this dude, that's all I can call him, this long-legged Texan with a great big old 40-gallon hat on and big old belt buckle and those boots, those Texas boots, you know, they got with the roach killer toes on them. You get a roach in the corner and just jab it like that. And he'd come on in and he said, "Mister, I got a $50,000 racehorse out there in that trailer, and I want a blanket for that horse, and I want the best blanket that you got. Now go on, get me one." So Thad, we know he kept all these blankets in the back of the room. And they're all the same. They're different colors, but they're all $20 blanket. We know that. Thad come on out and put a red blanket down on the counter. The guy said, "How much is that?" Thad said, $19.95. He said, you expect me to put a 1995 blanket on a $50,000 resource? Buddy, you got to be kidding. Now go on, get me a better blanket than that. I ain't got much time. So Thad went on into the back room and come on out a few minutes later with a blue blanket with a nice yellow stripe on it. He put it down and the man said, now how much is this one here? He said, well, this one here is $49.95. He said, you expect me to put a $50 blanket on a $50,000 racehorse? Buddy, you got to be kidding. I'm going to give you one more chance. My temper's wearing out here, and I want you to get me the very best blanket you got in the store. So we went on back to that same old pile of blankets and come on out with a nice big yellow blanket this time and put it on the counter. Texan said, how much is this one? He said, $99.95. I gave him kind of a funny look, and he said, I'll take it. Threw down a $100 bill, grabbed the blanket, and run on out of the store, got in his trailer, and just drove away. This was mighty interesting to us. Thad went on over the cash register, put his fingers on the keys, looked up to heaven and said, Lord, he was a stranger and I took him in. This last one is I'm not going to play the banjo. It's just something I use a lot when I tell stories. It comes in real handy. You can make banging noises and things like that. This story, I guess, deals with the anxiety that we all have about the unknown. Kids really like this story. It's kind of a creepy story. It's a story that's told widely in the Appalachian Mountains. It's an easy one to tell. It's a kind of a crowd pleaser. It's not much of a story, but you'll see why. But it really is about, I think it's about the fear of the anxiety we have about maybe killing animals, about hunting, about eating animals particularly, because part of an animal is eaten in this story, and the animal gets revenge on the person for eating its tail. It's pretty gross, but the kids love it, of course. It's called the Taily Po, the Taily Bone, goes by various names. It's told by a lot of storytellers. Once upon a time, there was a man lived up on Armenia Mountain up around Mansfield, Pennsylvania. And this man was a mean old man. And he lived in a cabin that had holes in the floor and holes in the walls and holes in the ceiling. And he made his living by eating roadkill. No offense, Doug. By eating roadkill and stealing chickens and poaching. And nobody paid much attention to him. And one night he was sitting in his cabin. He hadn't had anything to eat for about 3 weeks. And he was mighty hungry. And he's sitting in his cabin. And all of a sudden, he saw this critter come up through the hole in the floor. Now this critter was about this high. It was covered with green fur. Had great big red eyes. And stuff running out its nose. And hunkered down on the floor there. And it just looked at him. And it made the man so mad. He picked up a great big knife he had on a table. And he lunged at the critter. And the critter turned to go down through the hole. And just as it turned, he gave it a whack on the tail and cut the tail right off. He picked up that tail and it was a great big thick tail right at the base where he cut it off. Now it had all green fur all over it and it looked mighty ugly. But there was plenty of meat on that tail. He hadn't eaten in weeks. So he took it and he skinned the fur off and the skin, and he cut it all up and split it all up there and got himself out an old greasy frying pan like your mama does, you know, and fried that old tail up there in the pan and flipped it over, and then he ate it piece by piece. And it went down real hard. Funny thing was, every time he'd eat a piece, he could kind of feel it in his stomach. And it'd line up one piece after the other. He'd sort of feel like that tail's going back together in his stomach. But it filled him up pretty good. So then he went to bed. Now it was about 2 hours after he'd gone to sleep. And the wind was just dying out of the west. And the moon hadn't come up yet. It was real quiet. And all of a sudden, he heard this sound. And he woke up and he looked around and then he heard something else. And it went something like this. Taily Po, thine wants my Taily Po. called to his dog, and his dog boiled on out from under the porch and chased that critter across the field, on up into the piney woods, down into the swamp, and over into the next holler. And he figured maybe he'd be rid of that critter for good. So he got on back into bed. About the middle of the night, the moon had come up, and a big black cloud come over it, and it was dark as pitch. I heard that sound again.
Daily Paul. And once my daily
he called for his dog again, and this time the dog came out kind of slow. And he looked out and he could see the critter turn on the dog and come back on the dog and tear it to bits. And eat it, chewing its bones and sucking its blood. And it made the man so scared, he could hardly move. And he fell on back into his bed and lay there in a cold sweat, just a shivering and a trembling. And long about an hour before sunrise, when the wind was just picking up just a little bit out of the east, he heard that sound again. Only this time the critter come right up through the floorboards. And the man was so scared he couldn't move, come right across the floor, up over the end of his bed, down his legs, and it sat right on his stomach, right where that tail was. And it looked down at him with them great big red eyes. And it said,
"Tailie Paw, I gots my tailie paw."
And that was the last anybody ever saw of that man. But sometimes you go out in these mountains late in the afternoon when the wind's out of the east and you listen real close, you might hear that sound.
Now, we have looked at a number of stories, and we're going to begin a panel discussion here in a minute. But before we do, I'd like to introduce one other very distinctive American type of story that has not really gotten its play here, and that's the Tall Tale. And by way of introduction of the winner of the Tall Tale contest from last year, who's going to give us a very short sample of one of his tall tales, I'd like to tell a little tidbit, and this kind of reflects a lot of the thoughts about tall tales in America. And it has a lot to do with it. A tall tale teller is you're kind of born to that temperament, most people believe. There's not much you can do about it. It seems like there was this little boy, he's only about 6-7 years old, and his name was Jimmy, and he was known all around for telling these just totally fantastic made-up stories. A great deal of imagination and creativity was involved in these tales, but not a bit of truth. Now, no one seemed to mind very much. In fact, they usually liked Jimmy, and he was a great hit down at the country store and the movie theater and everywhere else, except at church, where his folks went, in Sunday school class. And word got to the minister one time, about what was going on, and he called the little boy's parents into his office, his study, just before service one Sunday, and he said, "I'm terribly worried about Jimmy. He's telling these tales in Sunday school to the other little kids. Why, even some of them instructors are listening and laughing into those stories." And he said, I guess that's all right in some places, but here we are, we're charged with a very, very serious responsibility. And that's to raise good Christian, truthful men and women. He said, and I've been thinking, now I know he's too young to really punish for telling these stories, he said, but I've been thinking about a way we might break him of that habit. And the parents looked at him, whatever the preacher said was, that was all right with them. And so he said, well, look, now you bring Jimmy in here just after service today. He said, and I'm going to make up some story. I mean something, just totally fantastic. I'll tell it to him. And I think when he sees an adult telling that kind of story, a minister, he's going to see how stupid it looks, and he might just get embarrassed enough not to do it anymore. What do you think? Parents said, well, I don't think they half believed him, but they said, yes, sir. Yes, preacher. So they went out, and after service, they brought a little fella in, oh, his eyes, you know, as big as saucers, you know, and take everything in at a glance. You know the type? You know, and there's the minister, and he's still got his robes on. I got a little velvet coming over the shoulders. He looked pretty impressive. And he just towered over that little boy, and he said, Jimmy, last Thursday, Lord, he said, we were in here having choir practice. Jimmy, front door to the church burst open, and the biggest black bear you ever saw in your life came running up the center aisle, just getting it. And that bear, Jimmy, was being chased by this little itty-bitty dog, no bigger than both your hands, snapping at the bear's heels, as it were. Well, when that bear came towards us, we forgot Amazing Grace and started for the choir room, I'll tell you. And just as I was going in, the last one, before I closed the door, I looked out and I saw that bear wheel around there at the front of the church and turn on that little dog, rear up. And he said, oh, I couldn't bear to watch close the door. He said, Jimmy, you never heard such a sound of growling and barking and whining. It got real quiet. After a bit, I figured, well, that bear done killed that dog and run off, sure as the world. So I pushed the door open, and Jimmy, don't you know there was that little dog? Not a scratch on him, wagging his tail in the front of the church. And there were bits of black fur and bone and blood scattered all over that church where he'd tore that big bear to pieces. And then he looked down and said, now, Jimmy, do you believe that story? And Jimmy said, why, sure, because it's the truth. That was my little dog. Marvin Marshall, if Marvin had come up, he's just going to give us a very short tall tale, and then I'm going to ask him to wait a little while later and give us a very short little family story. And we're going to finish this discussion, if we could. Yeah, just maybe put that straight up. And then we're going to discuss the role of folk tales and why we tell them. And then we're going to take a look at family stories, if we have the time, and open up for questions. Marvin Marshall, our winner last year of the Liars Contest.
Before I start my story, I know you're not going to listen until I answer this. You're saying, Saint who, looking at my shirt? Saint Erho, who's Saint Erho? Saint Erho is the patron saint of Finland. He drove all the grasshoppers out of Finland.
Snakes out of Ireland, grasshoppers out of Finland.
My story last year was the story of the Zigmal.
Ah, the Zigmal.
As many of you know, I'm a forester and spent many years around the logging camps of the north, scaling timber and working in the west and in the lake states. And here's where we get the tall tales of the animals and the snakes and all. But I think the most peculiar of all I've heard is the Zigmal. He lived in the cutover lands around the logging camps, and he was a small creature, very much like a possum, except between his forelegs and his hind legs, he had skin like a flying squirrel. And they had a great long tail, and on the end of his tail, he had a rubber maul. His means of locomotion were to back up to a stump, swing that tail and maul around over him, and kerwham down onto the stump. And he'd bounce up, up, up. And then when he got up there, he'd spread those legs and he'd go sailing off through space. They had never been able to catch one of these things. But one day the bull cook had just stepped out of the cook shack, and here was the Zigmal backed up to the stump, just getting ready to swing that tail around. And he grabbed an axe, and just about the time the tail hit the stump, the axe come down at the end of the tail, and cut them all off. You know what that bull cook did? He took and carved some heels out of that and put on his shoes. And then he went up on the cook shack and jumped off. For 3 days, he bounced out there and they went out with their guns and shotguns and kerbang. They fed him soup with a shotgun until he went out of sight.
The American Tall Tale, a great institution, one I am very much enamored with. All right, where do we start? We started with this kind of concept, what's a folk tale? And we were sitting there over lunch, and immediately all kinds of ideas started flowing and thoughts and concepts as to what a folktale is. Maybe we'll take a guess here. We talked a little bit about anxiety. As a way of relieving anxiety is one of the things that we tell folktales. The tall tale, I think, in a lot of ways, is a way to deal with a very harsh environment, an environment that was so much larger than we were and so untamed, as it were. We came in here, and the tall tale, it made it seem like the almost the Paul Bunyan kind of stories and the Davy Crockett stories. It brought a sense of humor, I think, and I think that's a lot of folk tales. I think every folk tale we have told here had humor, yeah, elements of humor. I've never heard a good ghost story didn't have some humor in it. You know, I've never heard a tale that just, well, I've heard tales, but I don't think I liked them very much. Ones that just kind of go right through. And I think this is the great pity of these movies that have been coming out. You know, the slasher type movies, that variety. You know, the woman's always, and always, you know, going into her car when she shouldn't and going into the bathhouse when she shouldn't. And everybody's sitting there saying, don't do it. You know, but they always do. But there's no humor in those. And I think that really bespeaks the poverty of these kind of stories that are now, I mean, what is storytelling today? Storytelling is what we receive through the mass media in large part. A lot of people say to me, well, we don't have stories anymore, you know, like the old days. People used to tell stories. We need stories. And I got to thinking, you know, oh yeah, that's true. I'm never really thinking about it. And then the other day it came to me, I was listening to radio or something. I said, we're surrounded by stories. We got so many stories, you can't turn around without hearing a story. You're always hearing stories from people, from the radio, from television, from movies, magazines, advertising are all, you know the Stroh's one, we were talking about that in the class. You know, dog goes in the kitchen, you hear the beer popping open. He said, you better be drinking your water. You know that one? That's a story, isn't it? It's an entire story. It has humor, it has elements, it's very highly sophisticated. And the expense of producing that, what do they say, runs about $250,000 easily just to produce that 30-second spot. A lot of sophistication goes into the stories that we're receiving. But I saw that movie recently called My Dinner with Andre, and for the second time, in fact, and I really liked the movie. And there was one image in there that he draws of this very wealthy woman who lives in this house. And, I mean, she's just filthy rich. And all she eats is chicken. She's got a thing about chicken. Doesn't care much for other food and eats chicken all the time. Eventually, she dies of starvation, surrounded by boxes and boxes of Kentucky Fried Chicken. The point being that the nutrients in chicken are not enough. They're not complete enough to keep her body and soul together, see? And I think in a large part, that's the kind of stories we have now in our society. A great range of stories that feed only a very small portion of our spiritual need. And maybe as a culture and as a spiritual creature who thinks in spiritual terms and sees in the physical manifestations of life that the spiritual forces behind them, be they the primitive animal forces and totem forces of a Native American mythology or the fairy belief, which is not a quaint belief. It's a very serious belief to a number of people. The forces behind what appears to be the reality that we deal with every day. And I think that maybe the kind of stories we're telling now are impoverishing us, and we're dying of a sort of a malnutrition or something. And that's my sense. And so maybe if we can get back to these tales again being told in this kind of setting and over the dinner table instead of watching the news, and so forth, we can begin to generate stories that have more substance to them. So anyhow, with that thought, anybody want to handle that? Make any comments at all, or not much to say to that? Do you agree or disagree? Do you think that's how it is?
Oh, I don't know. I think people tell stories according to their needs. I think that people tell stories all the time. They tell real good stories. Women, for example, I'm going to make some generalizations about women, so I'm ready for I'm used to getting attacked. But I've been finding today's women tell stories about their husbands to each other. Very elaborate and very humorous story. They're real hard for me to collect, but they do. And women also tell courtship stories. Women, get young women, like in their 20s, who've been just recently married, will sit down in groups and tell stories about how they met their husband and or their boyfriend, and you know, how they courted and this, that, and the other thing. And they're almost like epics and
hero sagas.
And they're well told. And they're well told. The American tradition of storytelling, I might add, has been, in a way, been overlooked by folklorists. The most oft found American story is found in a rural setting. A person tells stories about themselves. A local guy or a local gal tells stories to other people about things that they did that were funny, that happened to them. And that's folklore. It's American folklore. It doesn't stack up very well against the Icelandic sagas and the Tan and the Mabinogian and other things in folklore. But it is our form of storytelling, and I don't think we're impoverished at all. I'm out collecting all the time. I think Americans are great storytellers. They don't know they're telling stories a lot of the time, but Americans tell stories all the time.
Well, when I deal with the concepts of the family story, you know, I think this is where the great tragedy, if I'm going to be the purveyor of doom, this is where I do see a great poverty, because I do not see the family stories being told across the dining room table. And what appears to be a collection of very isolated instances, you know, circumstance, I believe has a thread. You know, we pick and choose stories. We had Craig Johnson in our class today, and he was talking about some of his family stories. And they were funny and they were interesting, but I wouldn't say they were, you know, tremendous or real unique. They're fairly simple stories. But the very fact that his family had chosen those stories, I mean, the reason they said they cared to remember, let's say over a generation, stories about Uncle George and this story and that story about Uncle George versus this and that story, begins, I think, to become a kind of a psychological view that family has, a sense of belonging. You know, it's them and us, okay, which we all have to some extent. I mean, it really, you know, I mean, when I look at my wife and my kids, I mean, it's not really, I can't say it's a combative relationship, but it's definitely, I mean, that's my family, that's my flesh and blood. I have a different orientation to those people than I do to even friends, and then to acquaintances, and then to business contact, and so forth. I mean, there's different levels of interest or amount of effort I'm going to put into a relationship. And we define that. Now, I'm thinking of Ireland, and the one I wanted to bring, my mom used to tell a story. She went over to see my great Aunt Alice in the north of Ireland, in County Tyrone, in Coal Island. And my great Aunt Alice was taking her for a ride, and this is in the 1950s, before the Troubles again erupted in Northern Ireland in their present form. And they were going down this road and they passed this field, and my cousin Alice very casually said, "Hey, that field belonged to us, but they took it." And she meant the Protestants had taken the field, because my family is very Catholic, okay, but they're in the north of Ireland, the minority. And my mother was very interested. She looked at this very nice little field and she thought it was clever. You know, she said, "Oh, when did that happen?" You know, it sounded like it happened yesterday. She said, 1740. And that was as real to her as if it had happened yesterday. Now, how did that happen? Through story. Our attitudes towards races, all these things are transmitted. Now, if we don't have these stories happening in our families, or somehow this new generation isn't getting the time because you got swimming lessons and you got, you know, everything else going on, and everybody's running six different directions, which is becoming an American phenomenon. Where are these stories going to be told? So then what happens is you start to pick up what is just the general story of the American, you know, you get the generalized stories, which tend to be the Star Wars and the slasher movies, if those kids happen to be really going to a lot of those type of movies, or the Porky's, you know, and it becomes, yeah.
Did you ever run across the story being lied, someone tell the story being lied?
Yeah, very common. Right. Right. Best diplomatic answer I ever received. I went hunting the story of the Flatwoods Monster in West Virginia. And it just happened to be that I was passing through Flatwoods and I'd heard about this phenomenon. It's something about a spaceship that landed and green men got out and walked around. And New York Times and CBS News caught wind of it. See, that's why you got to bury that giant into the night. Because then people come around poking around, want to know the story. Well, I had found this fellow that someone had told me, yes, he knows all about it. He saw it. I went up to see this old man. As it turns out, I got one of the best ghost stories I tell from him. That was a true story to him. But in the course of it, when I was beginning to talk to him, and here's this whole process of collecting, he didn't know me at all. I'm standing in front of his trailer. And I said, well, I like to tell stories. And